Middle of the week and plenty on the radio, from leaving baby animals alone in the wild, retail staff talking about abusive customers, and do young people really not know how to clean? This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
The torrent of abuse, insults, bad language just absolutely set me into the ground.
21-year-old Sharon says, I'm 21 and my apartment is spotless, thank you very
good
much, Sue Ryder, and germ-free. I can't relax if there's any mess in my place, and I can assure you I have a rigid and thorough cleaning routine.
He says, we have his peeve. And I said, we can't get in to see you. That hurt, that he couldn't, he thought that we didn't care about him.
And we'll start here on the live line. Katie got a call from Ed. Now, Ed works in a supermarket where he's had to put up with some terrible behaviour from customers.
I work in a supermarket as a checkout operator. I started when the COVID had started off, as I'd been in recovery of an illness myself. And it was my fantastic opportunity for getting back. I have to say, 90% of customers that come are absolutely wonderful. Get to know them by name. I'm a very dutiful person for my job. It's very important to me. It's really my only social outlook in these current days. Mm-hmm. The abuse, I'm not just speaking for myself, but speaking for many others in not just my own workplace, but in having done my research with many friends that are in similar positions as myself. The abuse we get is absolutely horrific.
Really?
The abuse we get is dreadful. That it even came down to yesterday was the worst of it.
What happened yesterday?
People have lost the run of themselves when it comes with social distancing. I've only had my first vaccine there early last week. So still waiting for my second. I do suffer with anxiety in general, and I have a lot of things kind of going on, but I hold my head up high. Mm-hmm. But people are just, especially it happened yesterday at my workplace, social distancing has gone out the window. Not just with my till, but with a few others, people cramming up, fours and fives, trying to push all their shopping on top of each other, walk on top of each other. I had a lovely lady at my till, first of all, and a little bit of banter. How are you? How was your day? People then crowding up on top. No control. We are a little bit down on staff at the moment, but holidays, days off and things like that. It's unusually quite busy earlier in the week these days. Mm-hmm. Next thing, a barrage of people up on top. The nice lady I was talking to, she got a bit wary. She mentioned, oh, social distancing has gone out the window. Is there anything to be done? I mentioned to the other people, would you mind just adhering to the social distancing, thinking of respect for her and mm-hmm. for them and for myself? The torrent of abuse, insults, bad language just absolutely set me into the ground.
So this was the person queuing up behind the nice woman you were serving?
Four people.
There was four, and were they all together?
I'm not to know who is which, but whereas there was two people that weren't together, there was a separation of two people behind the third lady. Mm-hmm. And then what she roared at me about was using foul language and everything, said they were family. They were all together. I said, I'm sorry, I'm not to know that. I'm not meant to know that. We're not psychic. Yeah. But the torrent of abuse. Then, of course, the first lady was very nervous. She was just kind of, oh, I'm sorry if I caused anything. I said, no, you're doing what is right for you. Don't you worry about that. She gave me a big smile. She said, you're fantastic, and went off.
And then you had to deal with the people coming out.
And then I had to deal with two strangers and one with her daughters. And they effing and blinding and all that. I had two of my work colleagues, one behind me and one in a till opposite me, who saw this. They were horrified at the level of abuse I got.
Well, that's Ed. Then later, James called Katie to talk about abuse from customers when he worked in retail.
Around 2 years ago, I actually left the retail trade because of verbal abuse. I was working for a company who supply building products, so we would have a lot of builders, you know, and different trades coming in. Mm-hmm. And you know, one particular day, I remember a builder came in. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not branding all builders like this, but one particular gentleman came in, and we didn't even say anything to him. He wanted the price on some products, and he just started a tyrant of abuse at me because he wouldn't speak to me. He wanted to speak to his sales representative, who wasn't available at the time, and he just said, I tried to appease him, I tried to get him prices, and at the time I had a co-worker with me, and they tried to appease him, give him the prices, but he just said, no, you're too expensive, and he just started abuse and said he's going to report me to the head office, and that he'll have me job, and like, what else could we do in that situation? But he was asked to leave the shop, and he didn't come back when I was there, but I don't know whether he has come back since. But it's that type of abuse, Katie, that I can relate with, just listening to Ed there this afternoon. It is very, very demoralising when you're being subject to that abuse just for doing your job.
Yeah, and like we were putting a certain amount of it down to the pandemic and the anxiety. No, this is pre-pandemic.
This has gone on, Katie, for I'd say probably around Celtic Tiger times. You know, my experience, and I was working previously in a major retailer, and I could even see it then, the way some people would, you know, talk to retail workers. You know, they would almost talk down to them. You know, as if, you know, you're not, you know, as if we weren't good enough, you know, for them. But we were only serving them and, you know, trying to get them a good service.
And is this idea, you know, we've heard it before, the customer is always right. Is that something that isn't helpful in this situation?
No, because I don't believe that at all, Katie. I believe in giving customers good service, being courteous, being friendly, try and help them as best you can. You know, I agree with all that, but there is a line as well. You know, if a customer is being abusive to you, you know, is shouting verbal abuse at you, that has to be a red line issue. You know, it has to be a line there, you know, where you have to say, you know, there has to be consequences for those actions.
Well, that's James on the live line with Katie Hannon. Now, fit, young and fearless on the playing field, Clive Clark spoke to Ryan Tuberty about collapsing in the middle of a football match and his heart stopping for 4 minutes.
For people who haven't got your back catalogue to hand, will you remind us of how we would know you from watching you in the sporting field?
I played for Ireland, obviously, at every level, and then I played in England for Stoke City, West Ham, Sunderland and Leicester City.
So your credentials are impeccable, Clive, let's face it. And you were at a barbecue last Saturday evening watching a particular match that had become very famous, a little bit infamous. Tell me what you thought when you were seeing what was happening with Christian Eriksen on the pitch.
Yeah, obviously we went around to a friend's house to watch the game and seeing the incident sort of unravel, and first reaction was he's had the same as I had, just the collapse like that on the field. You think straight away. Well, I think straight away. It's obviously very serious, and it was a cardiac arrest.
And you had you probably had a little bit of a trigger yourself, going, I was that soldier.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's like I've kind of lived that, what he's going through, what he went through then, and what he's going through now. I've experienced it. I didn't do it on the football field, but I done it at half time, but it was in the game scenario, and thankfully for him and for me, I think that's probably one of the safest places to have a cardiac arrest.
Of course. You were, we go back to your story then, if you don't mind, Clive, to 2007.
Yeah, I was a Sunderland player, but I was on loan at Leicester City. Mm-hmm. And I've just gone there on loan, as you do in football sometimes. I fell out with Mr. Roy Keane at Sunderland. It wouldn't be the first one. I went to Leicester City on loan, and it was a Tuesday night playing against Nottingham Forest, which is a big East Midlands derby game in England. And at half time, I was walking off the field, didn't feel particularly great, but just thought a bit lethargic or whatever. Sat down at a bottle of water, manager speaking to me, not really registering anything he's saying. And next thing I know is that I've woke up in the back of an ambulance after having a cardiac arrest, which was obviously very frightening for everyone except me, because obviously I was KO'd.
Well, that's the fascinating thing. As you say, you're knocked out, so you're not aware of the storm, that you're in the eye of the storm. You don't know what's happening around you until you're told afterwards. Your heart stopped, did it?
Yeah, my heart stopped for 4 minutes. So it was like, obviously, you know, a collapse. I banged my head off the floor, just sort of fell forward. And obviously all my teammates were in the changing room. I'm lucky enough that, you know, the physio at Leicester City, he's just recently left Leicester City, Dave Rennie, reacted really quickly. And there was an A&E doctor who was working for Nottingham Forest on the evening, which was very thankful as well, because GPs don't have to deal with this on a daily basis, where obviously an A&E doctor does, and obviously much more confident in that scenario. They reacted. They got me going on the fourth go of the defibrillator, which was they were struggling to revive me, and it was very worrying times for them. But luckily enough, on the third one, they got me going for a few seconds, and then on the fourth one, they actually got me going properly with a bit of adrenaline, I think. And thankfully, recovered quite well, but my heart stopped for 4 minutes at that time.
I'm not a medical person, Clive, but 4 minutes strikes me as a long time to have no heartbeat. What did they tell you about that?
Yeah, I think for every minute that your heart stops, it brings up much more more problems, you know, with other organ failure, and obviously the blood flow to your brain and things like that. So, you know, to walk away relatively all right after it is was a very lucky boy.
You got the four goes on the defibrillator. And just to put it into context, Christian Eriksen had how many goes?
I think it was one for Christian, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, so that would illustrate the gravity of your situation. Tell me.
It was pretty bad.
And Clive described waking up in the ambulance after the cardiac arrest.
I was still in my kit, yeah, obviously. I had my jersey sliced all the way through the middle. But I obviously still had my socks and shorts and everything else on. And I woke up, and my head was a bit sore, my chest was sore. They broke a rib doing CPR on that night. So I woke up, obviously, with a sore rib and sore head, and then looking down, I was like, obviously, trying to take it all in, and had one of the paramedics, obviously, in the back of the ambulance talking to me a little bit, and, you know, took a few minutes for everything to register.
Your wife got a phone call in the middle of it all.
Yeah, obviously, my wife, I had a house up in the northeast, and I just literally come down to the Midlands, and we were staying with her mum and dad. And she got a phone call. We only had a 9-month, 10-month-old baby at the time as well, so we were staying with me in laws. And she gets a phone call to say, "Look, at you know, things aren't looking great for Clive." Because obviously I'm in the changing room, only with the doctors and the medical team, and the manager and the CEO and everyone of Leicester. They're all on the football field, and my teammates. So she gets a phone call saying, "Look, essentially, you know, Clive might have passed away," which is obviously
quite a shocking. Somebody kind of jumped the gun, to say the least. How does she
respond?
Well, I think
after the third go, one of the guys who was in the room walked out and told the manager, saying, "Look, it's not looking good." And then obviously that news was sort of relayed back to someone who then, you know, wanted to be. I think he wanted to get in touch with my wife before broken the news, because obviously because it was a live game, stuff was happening on Sky Sports News and things like that, and you know, there was no, you know, social media as much as it is today, so I think they just wanted to get in touch with her and sort of break the news as such, which was they just said, "Look, it's not looking great," and then thankfully they rang her back saying, "Look, he's come around."
God, well, your poor wife. That's shocking. I mean, I'm sorry for you too, but I just to be told that and hanging on a thread, wondering what the hell's going on.
Yeah, no, it was obviously very distressing for everyone at the time. You know, obviously my family back in Wicklow, they were obviously all worried, and I managed to be able to speak to them first. To be fair, my brother and my father were ringing, and finally got in touch with me. I spoke to them when I came around when I was in the A&E critical care bit.
When you got surgery, then of course what did they do to you? What do after? And you have to remind me, of course, what age you were at the time, Clive.
Yeah, I was 27. You know, obviously meant to be coming into my prime as a footballer. You know, played hundreds of games, like back home in Ireland. Obviously played a lot of Gaelic football with Wicklow, and obviously played, you know, a lot of football matches, obviously soccer matches over there as well. And then obviously I played nearly 300 games as a professional. So I played like thousands of games in my life, and then to wake up at 27, being told you've had a cardiac arrest. They done all these testing. I was in hospital for 10 days, and they done every test under the sun.
Yeah.
And found that my heart was actually, you know, the fittest they've ever come across. And they actually had to take me off the monitors at night because of the alarm, because your resting heartbeat goes off at 30 beats a minute. My resting heartbeat was lower than 30 when I was asleep. So they had to take the alarm monitors off me, monitors.
Really?
So I've done every test under the sun as they could do then. And they came back that they couldn't actually pinpoint any heart condition. Other than obviously they knew my heart went into a rhythm that obviously stopped the bottom chamber of my heart from pumping blood. So I had to be, they gave me an internal defibrillator and implanted in my chest.
Amazing.
So I had that surgery while, I think it was like on the 8th day or whatever, after my, after my cardiac arrest, and obviously in the meantime being told that, you know, you'd never play football again. So it was mixed emotions for everyone.
You had a kind of physical shock to the system, and including a defibrillator now in your, which is, I suppose what that sends an electric shock to your heart whenever it stops or something like that. And
yeah.
That's one thing. But then you had the psychological horror show of being told it's over. 27 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, you were on the cusp of such greatness as well. You were in the middle of greatness, but you had more to come.
Yeah, like obviously, hopefully, it was only halfway through my career, and you know, it was hard to take that because all I ever wanted to do was be a footballer. You know, anyone would tell you, see me growing up, all you ever see me was with a football, going up and down the road, and you know, it was really hard to take, and it was such a mixed emotions because obviously, you know, I've got a kid, 9 months, 10 months old, a little girl, obviously. It was me everything at the time, and well, still is. But you know, then to be told that you can't play football, it was like, you know, it was such a mix of emotions. So you're very relieved and thankful on one side, but then, you know, you're good, and then you start worrying because obviously that was my form of income, and you know, we weren't paid the same as the players are today. So, you know, yeah, you earned a really good living, but you know, you're only 27, you've got a long life to live. I couldn't live off the money I made. So I had to then start thinking, what am I going to do? Because obviously you come over to England at 16, not really got an education or anything either. So there's a lot of worry behind the scenes, but a lot of, you know, thankful sort of to everyone that helped me be here today.
Clive Clark from the Ryan Tuberty Show. And on today with Philip Archer Hayes, do young people know how to clean? Sue Ryder of Cleaner Angels was talking about decluttering and cleaning habits, and Philip reminded her about her comments on young people not knowing how to clean.
Good morning. I thought that actually that I would be in trouble with having a minute of it out of my mouth.
Well, let's deal with less controversial areas and ease into that one if we can. First off, who are your clients and what do you do for them?
Well, my clients come from all walks of life, and I do a detailed, you know, house clean, and I also do the decluttering. There's different aspects of decluttering. We've done an awful lot of work for hoarders, people who can't help it. I mean, no one, you know, sets out to be a hoarder. It just happens. And it actually destroys their life in the sense that it gets out of hand, and they don't know where to start or how to do anything about it. And that's where we come in. And no judgment, because people can have all different issues, like, you know, mental health problems, alcoholism, deep depression, you know, and they just can't cope.
You can lead a hoarder to water, but I presume you can't make them want to continue to clean up, can you?
No, and it gets just, you see, it just gets out of hand, and they just don't have the capacity or probably the wherewithal to just, you know, and where to start. You know, I went into houses and we've had to relay, you know, the debris from the hallway right down and into bags and into skips that you can't get in. Sometimes it's been up to the ceiling. It's, you know, we've seen all sorts.
Right. But how often do people end up reverting back to their old habits once you've gone? And how often do they say, oh, God, look, I can see the wall and the ceilings and the floor again. I'm going to change my ways.
Well, a lot of them don't change their ways. I've actually been cleaning for a guy for the past 10 years, and I've cleaned his place numerous times. And when I go back, it's always in the same condition. He just can't cope with it. He just can't handle it. And it takes, he can, sometimes he mightn't call it for a year or two. And you go back and the place is just back to square one.
What's he doing, Sue? I mean, is he going back out to the skip as soon as you've left and bringing everything back inside again? Or is he just going and buying more stuff?
Buying more stuff. That's what he would buy more stuff. And he would actually just leave. The stuff would be in bags, like books and CDs and things, in bags with the receipts thrown on the ground. Lots of newspapers, lots and lots of newspapers. It seems to be coming through that a lot of people who are hoarders hold on to newspapers. We did a job for a lady going back about 2 or 3 years ago, and we started at the top of the house and we cleared out the attic first, so anything that needed to be stored, there was space in the attic to put it back up there. And I remember we didn't get the skip on the first day. We said we'll see what way it goes during the week. And we filled about 5 or 6 bags that day and brought them down and left them at the side of the house. When I went back the next day, all the bags were in, and she had gone through them, and she was making up little bags for other people that she was going to give this stuff to. She was making her job really hard, because I love to just get rid of everything. But she was actually making it hard for herself by bringing the problem back into the house.
And do you just get rid of everything, or do you say, hang on a second, there's an awful lot of this that could go up on eBay or adverts.ie and make a bit of money for these poor people?
Yeah, but they don't have the capacity, and sometimes they want to get rid of it. Now, we don't just go in. There is cases where we go in and we go through the stuff with them and say to them, what do you want to do with this? Because it is their stuff at the end of the day. Mm. You know, it's only if it's really bad and dirty and filthy that it's not for, you know, that they couldn't keep it. But there is stuff that they can. And then what we do is we often got storage boxes for them, and we would put the good stuff into the storage boxes, get them to write out an itinerary of what's in it and tape it to it, so that when they go to look for something, it's just written on the box and the containers, and then they go up into the attic. And, you know, make it easier for them.
Is this at times dangerous or hazardous to you and your employees' health, this job?
It is at times. We actually have to wear the white suits and masks and sanitise really well.
Now, hang on, a full hazmat suit or just one of those suits, the lighter kind of crepe paper?
Ones. Yeah, they're not great, but yeah.
And why do you do that?
Well, because to keep your clothes clean, first of all, and to make sure that, because if you've got something on your clothes, you're going home with that. You know, you'd be taking it and sitting in your car. You don't want to bring that into the car. So usually we come out and just take them off and they go in the skip. Gloves, masks, and then pull up the hood on the suit.
Now, you say that your top tip to householders is not to become your cleaner's friend. Why do you say that? Yes.
Well, I've gotten lots of calls from people looking for to do a once-off deep clean for them. And they'll say, we have a cleaner, but I don't want her to know you're coming. She's become like a friend through the years. And usually they have cups of tea with them. And then they're very nice at first, to, you know, would you like a cup of tea? And then the cleaner sits down and takes, like, that's the time they should be cleaning. They sit down and then the years go in, they become like a friend. And then if something's wrong, they don't like upsetting the friendship by telling them, you know, you didn't do this or you didn't do that. And it's not good.
And unlike me and my cleaning overdrive in the pandemic, Philip really has let himself go.
Do you think the pandemic pandemic is going to have changed people's attitudes towards cleaning, because I know my own has changed completely. Once the fear of people turning up at the front door unannounced and seeing the state of the place has been removed from my life, I felt quite liberated about just allowing the place to go to hell with, you know, balls of dog hair rolling like tumbleweed down the hall. I said, who cares? Nobody's going to see it. Do you think that people might have just all, we might all just have let our standards go, or is it just me being filthy?
I don't know whether you're filthy now. But I think the hygiene should become very much more important for people because of the COVID. You know, to keep the houses hygienically clean.
You're just in the pay of big cleaning when you say things like that.
I like cleaning and I like hygiene, but I do think it's very important. And when I said about young people, I wasn't really sure on them. They weren't trained to do it. I mean, I was trained from a very young age to clean, and it stayed with me all through
the years.
All right,
so this is a blame the parents argument then, okay?
I think parents do too much for them, and they don't have the responsibility. But when they get older and go out and live on their own or get married, naturally all these things have to come into play, and they have to learn how to do it. And sometimes people don't have a clue, and they've got a whole load of cleaning materials underneath their sink, and they just don't know where to start with them.
Really?
Yes.
Are you serious?
I went into houses and they'd have everything.
Well, hang on, sorry. If it says on the bottle, kitchen surface cleaner, how much more explanation do you need?
Well, they just, where will they start? Or what? They don't have a routine. They don't have a routine. And you don't need a whole load of products underneath the sink. You only need to have one or two. A good multi-purpose cleaner is good. That'll, suffice. It should be for everything.
You also say, I note, that if you do have a cleaner, don't get them to do the routine stuff. Get them to do the deep clean jobs, like the fridge or the cupboards or whatever.
Yeah, vary it around. Every week have a little different, make the routine different, because they get complacent just doing the same thing and you're only just seeing the one thing getting done. They should add on, like, a skirting's to be done in one room, this week, and next week the other room has to be done. A different routine every week.
Oh, cleaning skirting boards. Can we just ask builders to abolish skirting boards, please, and have walls meet floors? It'd be much easier,
wouldn't it? Yeah, it'd be very handy. I've been trying to all the way through the year think there's got to be an easier way that those skirtings can be cleaned without somebody having to get down on their hands and knees to do them. But it would be good for young people. It's an awful pity they don't do it in schools. Like, they teach them, they used to teach them like cook and stuff. Just the basics, even just the basics.
Is it part of the home economics syllabus now, that sort of domestic hygiene?
Know. I'm not sure.
Well, let's find out.
It would be good.
Your top cleaning tip before I let you go, please.
Oh, top cleaning tips. Is there something in particular you'd like to know how to clean?
Is there something in particular I'd like? My oven is a disaster zone. It's a big charcoal encrusted blob sitting in the corner of the kitchen. What should I do?
Well, we don't clean ovens, but there is great guys out there that clean ovens. We usually give their number to our customers, and they actually, that's their profession. They come in, they use very safe chemicals, and they do a fantastic job.
Well, I could listen to Sue speaking about cleaning all day. That's Sue Ryder from Today with Philip Boucher Hayes. Now, stop picking up baby animals in the wild. Wildlife experts are warning that small wild animals should be left in their natural environment. Here's Audrey Carville from Morning Ireland.
Next to a gentle warning from wildlife experts that small wild animals should be left in their natural environments, it follows reports that a young fawn was brought to a Dublin Garda station last week after being found in long grass in the Wicklow Mountains. We can talk now to the campaign's officer with the Irish Wildlife Trust, Pádraig Fogarty. Pádraig, thanks for taking our call this morning. The Gardaí, then, this little fawn was transferred to the Wildlife Rehabilitation Hospital in County Meath. Now, why was it wrong for the person to bring it to the Garda station in the first place?
Yes, so we get a lot of calls, particularly around this time of year, of baby animals being abandoned. And I suppose the message is that the majority of the time, the baby animals are not abandoned. So when birds come out of their nests for the first time, often they can't fly very well. In this instance, fawns, so baby deer, are left alone in long grass for quite a long time while the mothers head off to feed. And in the autumn time, we get reports about seals, because mother seals will have their babies on the beach, and then they might head off for hours feeding while the beach is alone, or while the seal is alone on the beach. So the majority of the time, the animals are not abandoned, and so they're just best left alone.
And I'm going to make people cry when I say this, because once they've been handled by humans, they can't be returned to their mothers. Is that the case?
For the mammals, the deer, when they're born, they are imprinted with the scent with the mother, so that the mother will recognise the baby when she returns or can find it. Seals as well, when they live in very large colonies, they will imprint with the scent. And so if a human has handled the baby, that scent basically has been disrupted and the mother may not recognise the infant when it returns.
Yeah, it's hard though, isn't it? People see these animals and they think they're abandoned. They're trying to do the right thing, but they have to resist.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, there are cases where animals are actually injured and they do need intervention. And there's an excellent website that we always refer people to. It's called irishwildlifematters.ie, and the details are on our website, and there are vets around the country that will take in wild animals. But really the first question you need to ask yourself is the animal injured? Is it obviously injured or obviously in distress? And in that case, then get in touch with an expert.
And is it possible, Pádraig, to estimate what the impact is on a young animal like that taken away from its mother at that age?
Well, it's not really. Now, the doctors at the rehabilitation hospital in Navan are very good, but particularly for the smaller animals like birds, for instance, the rehabilitation success rate is not great. A lot of the animals don't go on to survive. So that is why nature is always best in the first instance.
Yeah. And does it happen often? Do you see many cases of this?
We don't keep figures on it, but it does happen regularly. We start getting calls around March when birds are hatching out of eggs and nests. And then June, of course, is when the deer start giving birth. And then the autumn time is when the grey seals are born. So it does happen a lot. And as you say, people are coming into contact with these things. And obviously the reaction is one of concern. So they want to do something. Unfortunately, a lot of them are getting in touch with the Irish Wildlife Trust and other organisations before they do anything. So okay, a large amount of the time, people are doing the right thing.
Well,
it's just a good to every so often to reinforce the message.
Well, that's Pádraig Fogarty of the Irish Wildlife Trust for Morning Ireland with Audrey Carville. Then later, Damien Hannigan, Public Relations Officer with the Irish Deer Commission, was talking to Philip Boucher-Hayes.
Fortunately, a common issue at this time of the year that well-intended members of the general public come across newborn deer in the countryside and mistakenly think that they're abandoned. But sadly, they're actually, by removing the deer from the countryside, it's sentencing that animal often to a death sentence, because the newborn deer will not survive without its mother. And it's very difficult, even if the deer can be survived, to release it back into the wild, because it has lost its fear of humans. So, as I said, well intended, but unfortunately a common issue at this time of the year, as it is really one of the highlights in the wildlife calendar when the next generation of wild deer are born. But I suppose over thousands of years, deer have evolved, and the ecology of deer means that they've learned to avoid predators. And that means that when newborn deer are born, firstly they're born with no scent, so to avoid detection from foxes and other predators. But also as well, they for the first 2 weeks after birth, typically the newborn deer will not follow its mother. And what will happen is the mother will leave the deer in vegetation while it's feeding, and then return shortly afterwards. So if somebody in the meantime finds that deer and maybe touches the deer, the mother will not return to the deer. So really what we would say to people is, well intended, but leave alone. They're not abandoned. Not to touch them, not to move them. If you have a dog, to keep that dog on a leash as well and under control.
So does that mean that, Damien, that the transfer of your scent or your dog's scent to the fawn is enough to keep the mother away?
Yeah, in most circumstances, we have seen circumstances where, you know, something happens and the fawn is, or the calf is returned immediately and the mother will accept it. But in a lot of situations, the human scent of the fawn, the mother will reject the animal back. So it's really important to say that people don't touch or don't move newborn fawns.
And I presume as well that hanging around to see if the mother does return to the calf is also the wrong thing, because these are timid animals who don't like interacting or being around humans.
Absolutely. Deer are a flight animal, so they will avoid, in most circumstances anyway, they will avoid human contact, and they'll especially avoid dogs. So typically what we would see with fawns or calves, are referred to sika and red deer, and the fawn refers to our third deer species, the fallow deer. Typically what will happen is the fawn or calf will freeze when it sees a human, or will freeze when it will see a dog. And often people think that there's something wrong, but that's just part of their, I suppose, their ecology, in terms of, is to remain still and remain motionless to avoid detection.
Damien Hannigan from Today with Philip Boucher-Hayes. And on the live line, Philip Nolan was telling Katie Hannan about visiting his elderly uncle in hospital during the restrictions.
He's been in since around Easter time. He got COVID over Easter, and he went in and to one of the big Dublin hospitals. And it's basically just, he hasn't seen anybody. We met him last week for a few minutes, but we were the first person he's seen since he went in, basically. Like, do you know what I mean? I think it's very unfair, Katie.
What age is he?
He's 74 years of age. He worked hard. He worked hard all his life. He looked after his father. And then suddenly this horrible thing called COVID-19 affected him and hit him hard. And thank God he got through it. They looked after him great in hospital, and they're looking after him as well in there now at the moment, like, do you know what I mean? But he's missing missing the gentle touch, Katie. He's missing the love of his family. We met him last week for the first time since he went in.
So again, just remind people, he's been in for how long?
He's in since Easter, so about 3 months, but over 3 months, 3 to 4 months now, he's in there now.
He had absolutely no visitors at all in that time until last week.
Not one, Katie, not one. Like, he hasn't seen any of his family. We were the first people he has seen since he went in, since the day he was taken in by ambulance. And that's the sad thing about it. Like, and he's not alone in it, Katie, either. There's other people in other hospitals. I've been contacted by people in my own community who couldn't get in to see their son, couldn't get in to see their daughter. One man rang me yesterday when he heard your piece yesterday, your programme yesterday, that you were going to cover the story. And he rang me and said they haven't seen their father since he went in. He's got dementia, sadly he's got dementia. And they're trying to get in. And not, they won't let people in. I can't understand, like, what the problem is like.
And going back to your uncle, Philip, what kind of a shape is he in now after, you know, going through COVID and being on his own for that length of time?
He's lost a lot of weight. He's lost a hell of a lot of weight. We were disappointed at the amount of weight he's lost. Like, it took a hell of a lot out of him. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, his fingernails need to be cut. And they can't cut them. Like, under health and safety grounds, they can't cut them. His hair needs to be cut. And stuff like that. And the minute he arrived into the room last week, like, I'm 53 years of age, Katie, and he walked into the room. Oh, sorry. Sorry. He walked into the room, and he gave me a hug. He says, we have his beard. And I said, we can't get in to see you. We can't get in to see you. That hurt. That he thought that we didn't care about him or whatever. But we just need to show a bit of humanity here and show a bit of love and a bit of respect. And I respect everything the hospitals are doing, the HSC are doing. They're doing great work. But they just need to consider the people in hospital at the moment and the love and the myth that they're missing from their families and stuff. And I just think it's unfair, Katie. Like, do you know what I mean? It's unfair.
And I mean, obviously, you know, anyone would be very emotional around that. Would you have been very close with your uncle?
Yeah, we would as his one brother left, and his brother he looks after him as well, and all his nieces and nephews. He's very lucky to have us to look after him. We would have been over with him twice, three times a day. My children would have been there. We would have took care of him, brought him down to the shops, walked down to the church. You love going down to the church to meet people, to talk to people, talk to the priest. He had a great belief in St. Charles of Mount Argus. And we would have been over with him every single day. And from that, I got COVID and I couldn't get over to him. So the rest of my family stood in and they looked after him. And then suddenly he went over one day. He was on the floor and he got taken away with COVID. And we haven't seen him since. And it's just, it's a big hole in their hearts.
And when you say you walked in and he hugged you, did he honestly, do you think honestly believe that he had abandoned him? That was it not explained to him what the story was?
He's 74, Katie. Like he's not used to modern technology. I think he's had one Skype call. He didn't know what the hell it was. Do you know what I mean? Like, and really, his first reaction was he hugged us. He says, "Where have you been?" Because he's gone from seeing us every day to not seeing us at all. Not seeing anybody in there. Like, do you know what I mean? Nobody coming into him. Nobody allowed going into him like he used to in the hospital. And he didn't understand. And I was trying to say, look, they're keeping everybody out because of the COVID. And he says, yeah, but I've got me vaccine. So why can't you come in?
Does he have his vaccines?
Oh, he has, yeah. He has his vaccines. He's got both vaccines. Like, do you know what I mean?
And are you vaccinated? Would you be vaccinated yourself?
Yeah, I got vaccinated. Thank God I got vaccinated. And the great work done by the people in the vaccination centre, the nurses and the doctors out there. And thank God I got my second dose last week. But all we're asking, Katie, is simple, right? We're not asking for 10 people to be sitting around somebody's bed. Right, I'm asking whoever is in charge of the hospitals, either the HSC or the people running the hospitals, to let people in for half an hour a week or an hour a week. They can wear, we'll all wear PPE. We can do whatever they want. We can meet behind the screen, like with the nursing homes, and just show a bit of humanity. Right, show a bit of humanity, because I feel that the people in the hospitals have been forgotten about here. The pubs are opening, the events are coming back, there's people going out for meals to hold up. But what about the poor devil that has nobody, or has one daughter, or has one son, who can't get up, can't get in to see them, or are sitting there going, maybe they don't want me anymore, maybe they've left me anymore. They don't, you know, that's all I'm asking for, Katie. It's not much to ask for.
Well, that's Philip there. Then Penny called with her story.
Well, my story was in December of 2020. Unfortunately, I lost two beautiful sisters, one the 1st and one the 14th.
Oh, I'm and very, third, very sorry, Penny. That's a huge blow.
Thank you, Katie, very much. And on the 3rd, my sister was to be buried on the 4th. And I couldn't wake him, Michael, so I rang the emergency services. And they thought he was after taking a massive stroke.
This is your husband,
my
is
husband,
it?
My husband, Michael, yes.
Okay.
So they took him into James, of course, and that was at the height of the pandemic in James's, which I understood. So we come on from the 3rd, and he was still very ill up for about a week. And then he started to come around. And I really want to concur what that gentleman said. The lack of touch, talk, whether we were to sing, say a little bit of a poem, whatever, that lack was absolutely dreadful. But my big but is this. The care my husband got in that MESA unit, in the Patrick Cavanagh Ward, he wouldn't have got the care, the love from the staff. And also then, as he got well, he was put in then to a ward where he either go home, but Michael had to go to a nursing home, which I accepted. And he was put into the Kilmainham ward, which he was then in. And then we got into a very nice nursing home. And then he took another turn in the nursing home about 5 or 6 weeks ago, got the doctor, shifted back into the MESA unit, again, the care, blah, blah, but no contact whatsoever. Till my husband, which we were sent for on the Monday, and from the Tuesday, he was dying. And from Tuesday until my husband passed away on the 7th, the day after his birthday, that was the contact we had with my husband, that he couldn't Well, I'm sure he knew we were there because the love we gave Michael, I only have a beautiful son. And we were there. My son slept on the latter part of Michael's life, Friday, Saturday and Sunday. And as the staff said, if love could have saved Michael from you, Mrs. Hayes, and your beautiful son, Paul, Michael would never have died. But it's the contact of that gentleman said, the touch, the feel, the holding of the hands. I was vaccinated and Michael was vaccinated.
But you couldn't get in.
Couldn't get in. Up to we got the sad call to come that Michael was dying. And that is factual case.
Yeah. Penny, I just want to say, I to lose your sisters and then to go through this with your husband and think he was out turned the corner and and to lose him like this is, I'm just so sorry.
And as that gentleman said, that every spirit in my beautiful husband of 53 years and we're him for about four before we got married. I can tell you one thing, Katie, my whole life was around my husband and his life was around me. That's all I can say. And as he went through, and I know he's in a better place today, and as I said, my final farewell to him, I said, I know I was always loved and I know you were always loved. But all I ask is to continue your love, support and get me through this sad and difficult time. But I know he will, Katie, because he was a good man, very good man and a very good father.
That's Penny remembering her husband Michael on the live line with Katie Hannan. And in the afternoon, Catherine Thomas was talking to Jim Sheridan about Rock Against Homelessness.
Tell me about Rock Against Homelessness, because such an important night. Again, it's having to be done online and streamed and all that. So, but a big event for Focus Ireland.
Yeah, it's all down to Barry Egan. He got the whole thing together and he's working for free on it. And, you know, I don't know how he does it because he has to keep his other job going. And Dave Merriman directed it. And I'm basically supposed to be over it in some way. But really, that's just doing the interviews. I went out and interviewed a lot of homeless people. And it was amazing how together they all were. We, you know, we weren't looking on the negative side all the time. We were trying to show how, you know, somebody can get out of homelessness and things are okay. Because people always go on the dark side, you know, the homeless at the side of the canal in a tent or... But a lot of people get through it, you know, so it's just
that
about...
it's temporary for a lot of people,
it's temporary for a lot of people. You know, like I did Apollo House and I was really interested in the homeless thing with Glenn Hansard and Dean Scurry and Brendan Ogle, who became my friends. It's weird. Sometimes stressful.
How many years ago was that?
It was 2016, 5 years. Time goes fast.
And when you think of it, like I just looked up the figures because I hadn't I hadn't looked at the figures for a while. So the latest figures of homelessness, 8,082 people, and this was from say the 19th to the 25th of April, and these are the Focus Ireland figures: 2,193 children, which is a 232% increase since 2014. So that's why I was kind of trying to remember when Apollo House was for you guys.
You know,
I mean,
Apollo
it's frightening.
House,
Jim,
it had
it?
A lot of good results. It focused attention on it. It is frightening. It's scary and you don't ever want to go there. It's amazing the number of people who you meet. Like I met this famous economist outside Tesco the other day and he's like, oh, I was homeless when I was a kid. My dad was a, I forget, he had some occupation, like not a tailor, but like that. And then the place burnt down and they ended up homeless. But like he's one of the most famous economists in the world. And you know, Glenn had a bit of homelessness and lots of people have it, you know. I remember 69, all the refugees coming down from the north, 67 to my mother's house. So, you know, it's been there with me for a long time, you know.
Yeah. And your interviews, they're important because we can talk figures and we can get stuck in figures, but it's actually to put faces to figures and put stories to people. Because, as you say, we can all kind of tend to lump it into one negative problem. But actually, it's the faces, it's the families, it's the children, it's the people. And it's to humanise it.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes to separate it from addiction.
Yes.
You know, because a lot of people just think homelessness equals addiction.
Yeah.
Which is not true. They're two separate issues, and that immediately became apparent to us in in Apollo House, you know. Yeah. It's like we wanted to get in like families with kids, but like that's not going to happen, you know. They're not going to go into a tough environment where there's fights going on, you know.
And on his new series, Murder at the Cottage.
I've been on it about 6 years now.
And how are you confident, like how do you think viewers will respond to it?
It's very poetic. It's very unlike most true crime. You know, the origins of true crime are with Truman Capote, and you know, whether he wanted the fellas to be getting the electric chair so he had a great book to sell is kind of became the whole thing. And it's kind of can be a nasty territory, you know. But I just wanted to kind of approach it with a kind of empathy, and trying to understand Ian Bailey and trying to understand the family and trying not to take sides. But it's the empathy that's the most important thing, just the identification with trying to find a I think justice is just another name for God, but he's not here. You know what I mean? It's like you kind of lose your faith in God if you have a tragedy, and then you have to find it somewhere else. And for me, that's like in trying to find justice in the world, you know, like, will God show his face, please? And, you know, similar with the homeless thing, you know, it's like just trying to do good works, you know. My dad did that when my little brother Frankie died. He immediately became like a social conscious person and started. And
Frankie died quite young. He was 10.
He was 10, yeah. You know, it's a roundabout that everybody in the family keeps going back to and driving around and never getting off. So I understand grief and people like, you know, being in grief, like the French family. But I think it's an unusual documentary. I think it's people will find it different. Mm-hmm. Like I'm in it myself, you know, and you know, all I'm just seeing is, oh God, look, my shirt sticking out. And
was that a decision early on for you to?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just jumped right into it, like, as I couldn't understand any other way to do it other than to be there asking questions and getting answers, you know. And yeah, it'll be very interesting.
Okay, well, as I said, that's on this weekend on Sky Crime and Now TV. But The Rock Against Homelessness and Aid of Focus Ireland is this Sunday at 8. Tickets are on Ticketmaster, and everybody can find out information focusireland.ie/rock21.
Jim Sheridan talking to Catherine Thomas in the afternoon. Now, did you know that 12% of the Irish population have some sort of food allergy or intolerance? In the morning, Philip Boucher-Hayes was speaking to dietitian Louise Reynolds.
Well, a food allergy is really, it occurs when your body reacts to a food incorrectly. So the body thinks, oh, there's some harm coming from this food. It generally is reacting to a protein in that food. So your body then begins to kind of mount an immune response to the food. And this is usually the release of something called histamine. And people might be familiar with an antihistamine, a tablet you might take and get in the pharmacy, which you take to counteract maybe a swelling, or if somebody has hives, or, you know, it's to reduce the reaction. So it's basically an immune response that your body is, you know, treating something which is quite healthy, quite a normal food, but in that individual, the body is responding to it as if it's something it needs to fight.
So is a food allergy then specifically an inflammatory response of the body, and is feeling nauseous or feeling bloated something else?
No, they can also be involved. So it is really our immune system can react in so many different ways, Philip. But very often the common symptoms would be the swelling that people might feel around their lips or their face or their eyes, because they would be kind of the closest area to where the food is being taken in through the mouth. But also people may feel vomiting very suddenly or tummy pain. It usually has quite a quick onset. So it might be very quick, within maybe 30 minutes, or it can also be, you know, a little bit later in the day. But then if you're talking about an intolerance, and that's where people can kind of get a little bit confused. And you mentioned that figure of 12%, which you found surprising. So it's just a little bit over 1 in 10 of the population. But of that, about 3 to 5% are a true allergy. and the rest would be an intolerance. So, you know, it's between 3 and 5% of the population have a true allergy where the immune system is responding. And that's why it is important to get it medically diagnosed so people know what they're dealing with and they don't need to avoid foods unnecessarily.
Okay. And are the symptoms for an intolerance, Louise, excuse me interrupting you, but do they exist on the same spectrum as the symptoms for an allergy, or are they a distinct and different set of things?
Well, some of them could cross over, but you tend to, with an intolerance, you tend not to get the swelling. Very often they can come on more slowly. They tend to be things like bloating. So it's when the food gets further down your digestive system. So if people think of, you know, your mouth right through all the way through your stomach, and then the large intestine, which is like tubes and tubes of intestine that we have, very often it is by the time the food gets there, it may cause a problem. So bloating and pain, that can be associated with an intolerance to a food. So it can be a little bit confusing. I understand that people are confused about, you know, all of the problems that can occur. But I think what's important is that you go and have it medically diagnosed with a regulated test, because again, some people might be tempted to, you know, kind of buy a test or have something and pay a lot of money to send away tests and things like that. And really, the Health Products Regulatory Authority, the HPRA, they very recently came out and said that there is no scientific evidence for a lot of these.
Indeed.
Kind of
we'll come on to the woo tests and some of the nonsense that is out there in a moment. But if you suspect that you have an allergy of some sort, how important is it to keep on consuming the thing which you suspect you're having a reaction to while you're getting tested?
Well, that would be very important if it's celiac disease. So celiac disease is a reaction that the body is reacting to gluten, which is found, and people now are hearing a lot about gluten-free, and there's a whole range of gluten-free products now available. However, a true celiac disease is when the body is reacting to gluten and gluten must be taken out of the diet. Now, the problem with that is if somebody feels very unwell, gluten is usually found in bread and wheat products. So again, things like pasta, which is made from wheat and bread. So somebody who is feeling unwell, they might have bloating, they also might have pain, they may have some diarrhea symptoms. But if somebody feels that they have a reaction, they need to keep consuming that food while the test is done, because if you stop eating the foods containing gluten, you will feel really well. But then when you go for the test, that particular test, if you don't have gluten in your diet, the test will come up as a negative test. Now, the problem with that is, of course, if somebody stops eating the gluten in their food, they feel really well. And then if you say to them as the GP or as the dietitian, well, now you have to go back to eating gluten-containing foods before we do the test, people will say, no way, you know, I feel so well.
Mm. Dietitian Louise Reynolds from Today with Philip Boucher-Hayes. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.